Veterans Radio is dedicated to all the men and women who have served or are currently serving in the armed forces of the United States of America.
From the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, this is Veterans Radio. And now, here's your host, Bob Gould.
And good morning, good afternoon, wherever you are, could be either way, because we're broadcast around the world at veteransradio.net. If you know someone who would like to hear our program live, because we are live, have them go to www.veteransradio.net. Yeah, they can hear us even in, I think we've had emails from Panama, New Zealand, Australia. There you go. Have a Foster's, mate, along with a shrimp on the Barbie. How about that, Nina? Is that close? No, it's not. She's shaking her head. And, of course, on the board today, the wonderful and very talented Nina.
Good morning, Bob. How are you?
And how about to the world?
Good morning, world. We're excited to be here.
Yes. Okay. Well, it's very nice to have you. Today, we're having a brand new, and it's nice to have something new, right? So we're having a new feature that will be part of Veterans Radio monthly. Mm-hmm. But before we get to that, I'm going to talk about our sponsors. They're the ones that help us keep the program on the air. So let's start with number one. Who is the first sponsor? I have this thing written down, folks. It's U.S. Wings. U.S. Wings is a U.S. manufacturer of quality military flight jackets, paraphernalia, tchotchkes, all kinds. You know what those are, folks. Of course you do. You can find a P-38 can opener. Where are you going to find that today? Well, you can find one at U.S. Wings. You're going to want to go to uswings.com, and check out the selection, okay? Secondly is going to be the Marine Scholars Program at Ave Maria University. You'll hear a couple of spots for that. And, well, we're going to be right back with Mr. Dwight Zimmerman after this important message.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill, the benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, we're back. Veterans Radio. And now I want to talk about a new series that we're going to have on Veterans Radio. It begins today, the debut. It's going to be monthly. It's called Eddie's. That's right, Eddie's. Remember that? And then attention, and then Eddie's. It's hosted by award-winning author Dwight John Zimmerman. He's the newest member of the Veterans Radio crew. Dwight Zimmerman is an award-winning author and producer who has written extensively about the military. His most recent book is Saga of the Sioux, and the young adult adaptation of Dee Brown's classic book about the American West, Bury My Heart at Wounded Knee. He is presently writing a series of World War II 70th anniversary web articles for Defense Media Network. Please welcome How about that, Dwight?
Oh, thank you, Bob. That was great.
And we haven't done that with too many guests. But you're not a guest. Right, you're a host. And well, you just I told Nina to be sure and include the bong. I don't know what that, one of those big things where those sweaty guys, you know, they hit that. And we had to go a long way to get those guys. All right, tell them to go home now, Nina. They're done. Okay, the program's yours. And take it away, Dwight.
Thank you, Bob. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the debut edition of Veterans Radio Network's monthly program, At Ease, where we talk about what's new, topical, and exciting in the field of military publishing. I'm proud to have as my first guests Charles Chuck Oldham, editorial director of Faircount Media, and author, editor, game designer, television and radio commentator, and a whole lot more, John D. Gresham. I need to make a disclaimer here that I've known both of these gentlemen for a long time, that I've worked with and for both of them, and that they're good friends. Our first guest is Chuck Oldham. Welcome to the show, Chuck.
Hello, Dwight. How are you?
I'm doing well. Yourself? How are things down in Tampa?
Very nice weather. Really nice day. And I feel like I earned a bonus today because I got to see how to pronounce tchotchke, which I've read a million times, but I never actually knew how you would say it. So that's a great deal already.
We always are there to help. Chuck, tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do at Faircount.
Well, I'm the editor-in-chief at Faircount Media Group, and that includes all of our print publications as well as our website. Our website is www.defensemedianetwork.com, and that's sort of the basket in which we have all sorts of content for all the different sorts of publications we do. Faircount does a series of publications that we do in cooperation with various military organizations and government organizations. And we also have some of our own publications, such as Defense and the Year in Homeland Security, the Year in Veterans Affairs, and Military Medicine that we do on our own as well.
Okay, now Faircount is a rather large company, but not many people outside the defense community know about it.
Yeah, I'd say we're, in a lot of ways, we're sort of a niche company, a niche publisher, in that part of our model is that we work, as I said, directly with organizations like the Army Corps of Engineers or the Coast Guard, and we produce publications for them, getting out their message, you know, what they want to tell the world or the legislative branch or you know, the defense industry in general about who they are and what they do. And so a lot of the print publications we do have sort of a very directed and targeted readership. So not necessarily the sort of thing you'll see, you know, if you're at your local grocery store on the newsstand. So maybe we're not necessarily as visible as someone like, say, Aviation Week or what have you. But we also have our own publications, and those are increasing as far as their distribution as well. And, of course, the website is definitely getting us a lot more of an audience.
One of your publications is the Year in Special Operations. It's now in its ninth year. To people who might be unfamiliar with such things, can you summarize the type of content it has?
Well, sure. It's some of it. There's a certain part of it that's going to be history. You know, the nature of special operations is that you don't really learn until well after the fact, maybe if ever, what really happened on certain operations. So there's certainly a historical component to it where we try and run stories that tell, you know, what really happened in various operations. And then, of course, there's the year in review aspect where we go back over the last year for each of the major components of U.S. Special Operations Command, what they've been doing, you know, who's in charge, who's been promoted, what sort of deployments they've had where possible, and that sort of thing. And then we also profile various weapon systems and various units and personnel, and we do interviews with leadership.
You also do commemorative issues. The most recent one is, well, two of them, celebrating the Navy SEAL's 50th anniversary and then also the 70th anniversary of Pearl Harbor. Could you tell us something about those, please?
Sure. The Navy SEALs, the Team 1 and Team 2, SEAL Team 1 and SEAL Team 2, were officially stood up January 1st, 1962. And we did a commemorative for the anniversary. A lot of it, I would say the vast majority of it, was history. There were a couple of stories that dealt more with the SEAL teams today. But most of it was history, and it's a very interesting history in that it's not like, again, in special operations, it's not like a normal sort of larger unit like an infantry division or a naval command or Air Force wing or something like that. You know, a lot of the history sort of resides within the people who were a part of the unit. So there are sometimes different interpretations of events, and of course you have a tremendous esprit within the units. So it's a little bit more difficult to try and tell the story because there aren't necessarily the same sorts of written records and documentation that you would see with units that are not in any way black, in any way, you know, classified units, let's say. But it's very interesting. And the people, of course, who, you know, become SEALs or the people who are in special operations in general are truly amazing individuals. I mean, the absolute best of the best. So really an honor to be able to do a publication like that. Not as easy to do as some other publications because a lot of that history isn't necessarily known yet or generally out there, but a great honor to do.
You had mentioned one of the publications, Year in Veterans Affairs in Military Medicine. Can you tell us something about that, please?
Yeah, it's the book is more or less split down the middle, and one part of it is definitely the military medicine aspect of it, and a lot of that would deal with things like battlefield medicine and also the most advanced medicine being done today. The other half of it deals more with veterans affairs, and we're talking about veterans from, you know, World War II. I think we lost our last World War I veteran last year, but World War II on through today. And so it deals with everything from, say, the changes in the GI Bill, certainly a very, very controversial topic right now is the changes in TRICARE that are in the administration's budget proposal. But it also deals with what are the latest advances in battlefield medicine on the battlefield. So it's a mixture of coverage for those who have retired from the service or those who have left the service and those who are still on active duty. And it's really interesting. I mean, there's all sorts of things going on that are pretty amazing. The research and development going on in military medicine is just, it really is the tip of the spear. And there's so many things that end up passing on to civilian medicine that are of great benefit to everybody else out there in the world. So it's a very interesting sort of subject area to work in.
How can our listeners get these publications?
Well, you can go to www.defensemedianetwork.com. Once you get on that homepage, you'll see a link for multimedia. And in that link, there's a pull-down menu. You can click on publications, and you'll see the different covers of various publications. When you click on that cover, it will both open a digital copy of that publication, and immediately on the quote-unquote inside cover, as the flip book opens, there'll be instructions on how you can buy a hard copy or a print copy if you'd like one.
I'm on that Defense Media Network website even as we speak, and I have to say it really is an impressive website. How long has this been in existence?
Well, we first started a website for our publication, The Year in Defense, in June 2009. And that was actually, The Year in Defense became Defense because it became a quarterly rather than an annual. And at some point, we realized that we had all these other print publications that we were doing, and it seemed like it would be nice to be able to have that sort of content on a website as well. And our staff and leadership came up with the idea of Defense Media Network, which was a website that would be able to have content from or regarding Veterans Affairs and Military Medicine, Homeland Security, because we do a Homeland Security publication, the Coast Guard, certainly, Corps of Engineers, Army Materiel Command, and then all the other defense-related stories that we try and cover as well. So it was a place where we could have a wider audience for the materials that were in the print editions, but it was also going to be holding all sorts of new content, regular new content on all these different subjects. And that began in October 2010.
I'm looking at the tag cloud, and this box contains a huge amount of topics of military news, military history, issues, military, U.S. military, U.S. Navy, Army, Marine Corps, Air Force, research and development programs, World War II, Coast Guard. It's really amazing. And people do not have to subscribe to obtain this content. It's all free, correct?
That's correct. That's correct, yes.
excuse me. Tell me some of the... I'm looking right now at one called U.S. Navy Year in Review. What were the big topics this past year?
Well, you know, the big topic for everyone is pretty much the budget. You know, what's going to happen. There's, in addition to the cuts that are already happening, there's the threat of sequestration. I don't know if a lot of the listeners out there know that because of the failure of the so-called super committee to come up with a series of cuts that could be made to bring down the deficit, sequestration was something that would automatically take place. It'll take place, actually, I believe it starts to take effect in 2013. And if that takes effect, if the Congress can't find a way around it and find a way to, you know, make these cuts themselves, it's going to cut another 600 or so million from the defense budget, basically. Well, from the budget overall. So there's a worry of that, but the cuts are already taking place. And certainly each of the services, they're already looking at drawing down force structure. There's the Navy, for example. It looks like the Navy is going to, unless Congress does something about it, have to get rid of 7 Aegis cruisers, as well as some amphibious ships. There are all sorts of cuts being made and all sorts of cuts being looked at. Certainly another aspect for the Navy this past year has been an increasing emphasis on ballistic missile defense. You know, there's now going to be a squadron of BMD ships or BMD ships being based out of Rota in Spain. So that's taking place. And then there's the, I wouldn't say the turn toward Asia-Pacific, but the recognition that there are some new challenges in the Asia-Pacific area for them. China certainly is building up a blue water fleet. And then there are all the, you know, the usual sort of housekeeping details. You know, we had a new CNO take command. And you know, just the usual sort of movements back and forth and then deployments that go on day in, day out, that people are maybe not as aware of as they should be. You know, there are kids out there, there are young men and young women who are risking their lives every day, even when they're just undergoing training exercises. And I don't think people are necessarily aware of that.
Our listeners really do need to go to this website, www.defensemedianetwork.com. There are just so many things. I'm right now looking at one of the new articles that was posted, the U.S. Coast Guard Diversity Strategic Plan. So tell us, are some of the challenges the Coast Guard is addressing for the 21st century?
Well, you know, the Coast Guard is a really, really amazing service. I mean, it's in a way, it's almost a two-hatted service in that in times of war, the Coast Guard becomes essentially the fifth service, the fifth armed service. And it also is part of the Department of Homeland Security and is the only service that basically can have a law enforcement function, an arrest function, that sort of thing. And this is with an organization that basically has, they have a bit more personnel now, but when we were doing this book earlier on, they had an in strength that was about the size of the New York City Police Department. And yet, they have a tremendous amount of responsibilities. They protect our fisheries. They make sure that we don't have ships dumping their bilge in every harbor of our country. They have the Homeland Security functions. They have to make sure that there isn't something in a container that could be a weapon of mass destruction. There's the law enforcement function, maritime safety. They take care of all the aids to navigation. They do the ice patrol, where they make sure that there aren't, rogue icebergs that could take out some kind of shipping. There's a tremendous challenge now that's starting with climate change and the Arctic ice starting to melt. You had the Northwest Passage that historically has been iced in year-round, and now it's opening up. And because of the ice melting, there's access now to all sorts of different resources. So you have a bunch of different nations saying, we want to get a hold of those resources, and you have much, much more ship traffic, which means much more potential for a ship going down, much more potential for pollution, much more potential for different nations getting entangled in disputes over who has the rights to what minerals on the seabed or oil drilling or what have you. So Coast Guard is very challenged, and at the same time, their budget's very small. They still have cutters that are 40 plus years old, and frankly, they need a little bit better cut of the budget, and so far, they're not getting it. That's my personal opinion.
We've been talking about current events, but there's also a large section here, military history. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. That's for me. That's probably the most fun of being able to work on this website. I'm definitely a history buff, as I know you are as well. We have, of course, the ongoing series, which is World War II 70 years, which you're writing. We do four monthly pieces that essentially match up to whatever was going on that month, all the way back in World War II. So I think we've had a good time doing stories that are not necessarily the run-of-the-mill stories, the history that everybody thinks they know from school or from their own reading. Really interesting stories about various people and units and events that took place that are maybe a little bit off the beaten path sometimes, but definitely very, very interesting sort of stories. And then we also have regular history pieces, a lot of aviation history pieces from Robert F. Doerr, Walt Boyne, all sorts of different writers who have contributed those pieces, and also naval history and army history, land forces, various personalities. So we've got a good mix, and as I said, that's really one of my favorite parts of being able to work on the website, is being able to work on the history section.
Yeah, it is really impressive. And again, everyone, please go to the website, www.defensemedianetwork.com, and just have a ball. It is so amazing. The site is extensive. It contains all kinds of material. And I think that you can spend all day here and learn so much more about it. Chuck, we're nearing our break time, so I would like to say, is there anything else that you would like to add to this?
Well, I encourage people to come to the website. As I said, you know, we have a lot of fun doing it. It goes through changes and evolution. We're always working to make it better. But it's a lot of fun to work on from our end, and I hope people will have fun reading it on their end. And I think it's a good mix of very, very up-to-date news on military events, as well as being a good site to be able to look at some of the important military history of the country.
What are some upcoming publications that our listeners need to know about?
Well, we just on Friday put our quarterly issue of Defense to bed, and that went off to the printers. And we'll just be beginning production next week on the Year in Special Operations, which will be out for the SOFIC show, which is, actually takes place here in Tampa, just up the road from SOCOM and CENTCOM, which are based at MacDill Air Force Base. And, what else are we working on? Well, it won't be long before we're in production on a book on the Defense Security Cooperation Agency that we've been working on with the agency. So a good mix of our own publications as well as some of our client publications. It's okay. Going to get busy.
Dwight, yeah, there's a minute and a half before we go to break.
Okay, and well, Chuck, that is just so interesting. I did obviously know a bunch of what you did, but you told me an awful lot more. So again, everyone, I would like to encourage you to go to the website, www.defensemedianetwork.com. You can make comments to various articles, and we certainly encourage you to do so. Let them know that Faircon is doing some fine things here. And, Chuck, I just want to say thank you so much for being a part of my program, my debut program. I greatly appreciate it.
Thank you, Dwight.
So, take care. So, Bob, how about that? I thought I learned some things here.
Oh, yeah. And we always want to tell our listeners, keep a paper and pencil handy when we give you all this. This plethora, how about that, of information. And we're going to come back in about, what do we have, Nina, a one-minute PSA, right? So we've got that coming back, Dwight. And again, I think you're doing a heck of a start job. You always got to have a beginning, right? So we're going to be right back right after this very important message.
You're full of fear, you're breathing fast, your head's pounding, and all you can hear is, I don't want to do it. You get to the top, get hooked in, and then you look over the edge. I thought it was 1,000 feet, I was like, no way am I jumping off this tower, I'm staying right here. I'm like, am I ever going to be good enough to be a Marine? Every day it got harder, but every day we got stronger. And I thought, yes, I can do this. When it was all said and done, watching the car guard raise the American flag, hearing the national anthem, it was amazing. I've never felt anything like that before. At that point, I thought, I am a United States Marine.
PFC Keith Falcon knows you don't join the Marines, you become one. Visit Marines.com or call 1-800-MARINES. The few, the proud, the Marines.
Okay, we're back on Veterans Radio. Nina's working on getting John back on the line. These things happen. Oh, all right, she's got... So, we're here on Veterans Radio, and I have with me, with his debut, Mr. Dwight Zimmerman. And you've done fantastic. I like all this information. And here's a little something for Chuck. Yeah, it's Chotsky, Chotcke. That's right. And that's Yiddish. And what it means, when you go on vacation, you get a little tchotchkes, you know, a little mice and a flag or whatever. So you can get those things at U.S. Wings. Okay. Go ahead, Dwight.
Okay. Well, John, welcome aboard to At Ease. Glad to have you
Thank
here.
Thank you for having me, and it was fun listening to Chuck.
Yes, indeed. So, John, you've got a huge background, you know, in this whole area. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Well, I grew up in Southern California, very much with a family that was involved in the aerospace industry in various forms. Went into it myself for about a dozen years, doing various things in the consulting, aircraft, and training business. And eventually kind of evolved into a military history storyteller in the early 1990s. I've written 15 books, which, given full disclosure, I must say two of which are with you. And I am the editor of that publication that Mr. Oldham mentioned, The Year in Special Operations, which we're currently working on feverishly for the May rollout date this year.
Yes, indeed. Well, you also had an important role assisting Tom Clancy in his guided tour series of books. Can you tell us about that?
Well, in late 1992, I was invited by several mutual friends to join Tom as part of a team writing effort to go and write a series of nonfiction guided tour books of actual U.S. military units. We started out with submarines. Turned out we did both British and American. And we did a total of 7 of those books during the 1990s that were all New York Times bestsellers, and we finished up, ironically, with one called Special Forces that turned out to be a whole lot more influential on my future course as a writer and historian than I had any reason to expect.
Okay, so what's your role at Faircount exactly? I mean, you mentioned that you edit Special Operations publications.
Well, one of the things you have to understand about the Year in Special Operations book is that it is the largest of the publications that Faircount does in a given year. Largest from the standpoint of total print run, so much so that we actually do wind up producing extra copies for newsstand sales at fine newsstands everywhere. But also in terms of the total volume and outreach we do to a particular community. And so some years ago, Mr. Oldham and the management there made the decision that they really wanted someone who had a background as well as the contacts within the special ops community to come in and be a consultant to help guide the effort, and that has led to my now being consulting editor for much of the last decade.
These publications, they cover the full range of material from events of the past year to historical and forward-looking material. Can you tell us some of the highlights of what they can expect from the latest edition?
Well, it's worth noting that this is a big year of anniversaries for the community. In particular, it's the 25th anniversary for U.S. Special Operations Command itself. It's also the 50th anniversary for the SEAL community, the 50th anniversary for the best known of the Special Forces groups, the 5th group out of Fort Campbell, the 30th anniversary of the 160th Special Operation Aviation Regiment Night Stalkers, and, you know, even the Army Rangers. It's their 70th anniversary. So we're going to have a lot of material to cover in one very limited publication to go ahead and pay appropriate respect and homage to these units. And we're also going to try and give some sense of how and why they came into being, not just the service they've done, but the rationale, if you will, to the public of why these people were drawn together into these very, very extraordinary groups.
I'm looking at on the website, which, again, everyone, it's www.defensemedianetwork.com, as John has been speaking, and the range of subjects that are covered, right now I'm looking at new robot systems that are being developed and tested. There's an article here by Scott R. Gorley on this. You know, can you tell us about these different... Well, you've written about weapon systems yourself.
With an appropriate homage to Scott, who is among our best writers. I'm very fortunate that I get to pick and choose who I want to do this, and consequently, I've got a truly extraordinary group of people who provide us a great deal of access. They range from Air Force General Rich Comer, who is a deputy at AFSOC, to Scott, who does a lot of our advanced technology and naval warfare systems. I've even got well-known British writer Nigel West, who does an international section for us. So we cover this whole thing with a big, big umbrella and a lot of talent. And in particular, you've brought up one of our pet topics, which is the whole question of unmanned systems, for which SOCOM and the Special Operations Forces have been incredible adopters. They are what the Apple people would call early adopters. They are willing to go ahead and leverage high technology like unmanned systems and such to go ahead and to give them an edge in maintaining their stealth operationally as well as to increase their situational awareness. And Scott's upcoming piece is going to be a real tour de force of this. Something, by the way, I think we're going to cover to a very, very high degree over the next 2 to 3 years as we begin to evolve the second and third generation of unmanned systems, both aerial as well as underwater and ground.
You were involved in this publication about the F-35, correct?
I had a piece of that, yes. I did a number of articles, particularly about the engine system, and it's a great publication. We've done another one on the F-22 earlier, sort of with Big Brother, and I think if you read through that publication, you're going to get a great deal more fidelity and understanding of this very complex system that, frankly, mainstream media just is never going to give you. We can take the time to go ahead and lay out a good basic technical understanding of what things are, as well as the politics and the realities of how they got that way.
Yeah, because the F-35 project has been dogged by a lot of controversy.
Well, it is the biggest weapons procurement in the history of mankind, and it is, in theory, going to probably be the last manned tactical aircraft the United States will ever build. And so consequently, it's drawn a great deal of scrutiny, obviously, and at the same time, people need to understand that just because it draws scrutiny and it is a well-watched program doesn't mean that it isn't important to the country and well worth the money being invested. We're going through a period of time when the system is in development, headed into production and deployment. This is the time when normally programs show their warts in terms of design problems or shortcomings. And this is not unusual. This happens for things as simple as battle rifles like the M16 or as complex as nuclear submarines like a Virginia class. They all go through these kinds of growing pains and evolutions because what you're talking about are devices that have to work out at the very extremes of the real world.
You're mentioning that the F-35 is going to be probably the last manned aircraft. So this means that we're going to see an awful lot more drone activity and development?
Oh, unquestionably. I still think there might be room for one or two more manned aircraft that the U.S. will procure, and I would think those would come out of large transports or possibly the bomber development that's going on right now. But we see even in new airplanes that are going to have ejection seats in them, the requirement they are able to be operated in an unmanned mode, such as the bomber. I don't think we're going to see any decrease in unmanned systems. If anything, you're going to go and see a world much more like the robotic scene in movies like Star Wars than the present day.
On the less high-tech side, there's this article, again, by Scott Gorley, Small Arms Developments, in looking at some basic things as bullets.
And that is an equally high tech, albeit very, very, you know, grassroots kind of thing. You think, okay, haven't we learned everything there is to do with bullets? On the contrary, we've got new materials, we've got new chemical explosives, we've got all new aerodynamics and sizes. There have been at least a half dozen new standardized caliber rounds for everything from pistols and personal defense weapons to high-end 50 caliber rounds for sniper rifles that have come into the vogue in the last decade. And this opens up vast options for gun designers as well as the people who actually produce the bullets. A lot of people don't think of this, but, you know, in the U.S. government, out of just one plant in Lake City out in the Midwest, produces 2 billion loaded and packed bullets every year. 1.5 billion of that, 3/4 of it, is the traditional 5.56 by 45 round fired by the M4 and the M16. But we are now seeing them ramp up production for some of these other new rounds for issue to specialized groups like special operations out in the field.
Tell us about MARSOC and the work that you're doing with on that.
Well, MARSOC is a relative newcomer to special operations. One always thinks of the Marine Corps as being elite, and in fact, they have maintained throughout the past several decades seven what are called Marine Expeditionary Unit Special Operations Capable. These are basically the afloat battalions and other supporting units that go out on board amphibious ready groups for six-month deployments around the world. What a lot of people don't know is that they've maintained a small core of special operations capabilities, including raids, hostage rescue, shutting down nuclear reactors and such, during that time. But only in the past few years, with the Marines always trying to maintain a certain independence from the rest of the U.S. military, have they decided to create a component, Marine Special Operations Command, or MARSOC, down at Camp Lejeune and Camp Pendleton. And they're standing up battalions of special operations capable, actual special operations personnel. These in many ways resemble the Rangers of the 75th Regiment down at Fort Benning and other locations. But they also have components for foreign internal defense training, cooperation, and they provide a badly needed segment of muscle and firepower to the operations of SOCOM that previously had only been borne by the 75th. They're coming on fast, and they're gradually going and evolving new capabilities. We think we're going to see, for example, the first MARSOC aviation capabilities here in the next couple of years, which could result perhaps from the stand-up of several squadrons of B-22 Ospreys.
John and Dwight, we're going to have to take our third break. So hold your thought, John. I want to talk to you maybe a little bit about that 35 when we get back. Right now, you're listening to Veterans Radio. Take it, Nina.
You have honorably served the United States and the Marine Corps in times of peace and war. Now we would like to serve you. The Marine Scholars Program covers the total cost of attending Ave Maria University. By combining resources from the Ave Maria University Marine Scholars Funding, federal financial aid entitlements, and the GI Bill. The benefits are granted for the duration of the recipient's study at Ave Maria University, contingent upon good conduct and good academic standing. The Marine Scholars Program is open to all reserve and active component Marines and other combat veterans of Operation Enduring Freedom and Operation Iraqi Freedom who have honorably served our country. Please visit us online at www.avemaria.edu. Or call the Assistant Director of Admissions at 239-280-2552. You helped us. Now let us help you. Semper Fi.
Okay, you're back on Veterans Radio. John, I just want to very, very briefly tell our audience, we talked about the F-35 and what its implication will be on the Air Force and where they're headed in a past program. And you can go to the Veterans Radio Archives by going to www.veteransradio.net. Be sure it's .net. Look under past programs, look under archives. It was about a month ago, and it had Dr. Rebecca Grant, who was a spokesperson and writes many articles for the Air Force. So I'm interested in finding out more information on this unmanned. So, John, I'm listening, and Dwight, take it away.
Okay. So, John, obviously the big event in special operations this past year was the Osama bin Laden mission. So what are we going to find in the Year in Special Operations article from Faircount on this?
Almost nothing. there will be a mention of it with regards to SOCOM, but you need to understand that we have a small editorial policy that's one of the reasons we are able to go ahead and be friendly with the special warfare community, and that is, yes, we acknowledge that it happened. We acknowledge that it was a seminal event in special warfare history. But because the units involved all were with the Joint Special Operations Command, or JSOC, which themselves is composed primarily of clandestine, non-officially acknowledged units, we tend to follow the policy of SOCOM Public Affairs of not discussing those units and never mentioning the name of the personnel unless it involves a major promotion such as the commanding general. Now, some people might say, well, that's a sellout and you're bowing to the wishes of the man. Well, you have to understand, if the names of those young men were to ever become public, they would, one, be taken out of service and with their families would immediately be put into witness protection, and two, those units would, in fact, become combat ineffective. They would just be hunted down and killed by the very people to which they are assigned targets. So we have to make some editorial compromises and thoughts to the realities of things. We will talk about the bin Laden raid. We will mention that it occurred. But, frankly, we're going to maintain our policy. And the upside of that is that we usually, within a period of a year or two after it happens, get the opportunity to talk about some very unusual and very interesting operations that were never officially acknowledged or acknowledged in detail. So consequently, there is a benefit to us going and being discreet and being patient. We do that.
Another subject that is big nowadays is cybersecurity. Obviously, when we're talking the military, that's critical. Tell me about the articles that Faircount has done on that subject.
We've been going and talking about it to the degree that we can. Obviously, cybersecurity is another clandestine area for which there's very little acknowledgement and very little in the way of real information. What we pick up on the sides. That said, I know that we are going to be looking harder and harder at recent history of known cyber attacks, known cyber tools, known cyber weapons, and beginning to talk to the people who go and do it. Now, that's going to mean we're going to wind up talking in circles or around the core issue to some degree. But if you're willing to sit down and listen and look at the actual processes we're talking about, you can get a very good sense of it, much as you can with electronic warfare. I mean, there are good histories and studies of electronic warfare, but the EW community is much like special warfare. They keep their mouths shut and their powder dry.
I'd like to step back a little bit and talk about some of the television documentaries that you've been on, because you've been on a number of them over the years.
And working on more now, actually, yes.
Well, tell us about that.
Well, I'm currently finishing up a program called Under the Radar. That's the working title for the Discovery Channel that looks at sort of urban myth type of things and brings the realities around them to light. Everything from the Air Force Space Fence to questions about a bioweapons lab up off the coast of Long Island. We're working that, and we'll see how that comes out. That very much could go to a series. Obviously, I've done a great deal in the special warfare community over the years, and in fact, I'm in the process of pitching several series right now through several film companies out to various vendors. I'm also doing a documentary, it'll actually be a NOVA for PBS this fall, on unmanned aerial vehicles. So I stay busy across several different forms of media, and I'm obviously capable of doing that. I photograph things professionally. Chuck and the folks at Faircount have published a number of my pictures as illustrations for articles, as well as books and magazine articles.
One of the documentaries you worked on was dealing with the Hitler bunker. What network was that for?
That was for National Geographic Thanksgiving in 2008 release. It was called 42 Ways to Kill Hitler, and I worked with a guy who actually wrote the book on 42 Ways to Kill Hitler. It turns out there were 42 separate attempts that we know of. And the bottom line was that we traveled literally around the world, including Eastern Europe, to go to the sites where assassinations of Hitler took place. And one of those sites that figured very big in our series, in our story, was in fact the Wolf's Lair in what was then East Prussia is now Eastern Poland. And yeah, I got to actually stand on the place where Hitler was standing when the bomb went off on July 20th, 1944. We measured it in great detail, took a look at materials and construction and architecture on the place, and did a very accurate recreation about a month later out of a bomb range in Folsom, California, and that appears in the program as well. Along with that, we also got to see his big bunker there at the Wolf's Lair, went to Munich, went to Berlin, spent some time in the Gestapo and SS archives. It was a very fun program to work on. And when documentary projects are fun, when you're working with a good subject, a great crew, as I was with Indigo Films out in San Rafael, California, a fantastic director, and frankly, an amazing, amazing cameraman who I've worked with now for a number of years, you almost hate to take their money. It's that much fun.
You had an interesting situation occur to you on your flight back, something to do with your luggage getting tied up at customs?
Oh, yes. Well, that was actually several weeks later. I was attending a conference, and one of the things you have to realize is that the Germans blew up the mass majority of the Wolf's Lair complex in early 1945 in anticipation of the Russians overrunning it. And I literally crawled all over this stuff, and I had my backpack bag that I keep everything in, my camera, my computers and such. And just a week later, I was down in Orlando, Florida, coming back from a conference down there, and I suddenly realized they were using the new generation of chemical sniffers. And I realized I was going to have a guacamole of explosive residue all over that thing. And so I kind of alerted the guys to the fact that, yeah, this is going to hit, and they immediately went nuts because it's all World War II era explosives, the German plastique, TNT, black powder, whatever it was used in various parts of the demolition of the bunkers. And that's when, thankfully, one of the TSA workers recognized me from television and realized what I was talking about, that, yeah, I really was crawling all over Hitler's bunker where all that residue had come back from in 1945.
And you finally were able to get your bags through there without...
It was not a problem. It's just a matter of you have to provide a reasonable explanation. And what I do is sometimes a little odd to most people. You'd be amazed what the business of producing media content from written words to high-definition video, you'd be surprised the places it takes you, the positions you are put in to go ahead and make them happen, and frankly, some of the individuals you work with.
I would say, well, John, this has been absolutely fantastic. I'm really thrilled that you, you know, were able to take some time out of your schedule to, you know, be on my debut program.
It's a pleasure, Dwight, as it has been working with you. I would like to answer the other host real quickly and say, I am so glad that you had Rebecca Grant on, because frankly, she's one of the foremost experts on large bombers and their history in the country today, and the work she does is first rate. As for my own views, I think we're going to see manned aircraft rapidly exiting the scene because unmanned systems are cheaper to buy, cheaper to operate and maintain, probably more effective, and lower risk for the country that uses them. And this may sound really cynical, but because they don't have ejection seats and men in them, they will not function as hostage delivery systems to the despotic regimes we actually use force against. So I think that we're going to see a lot more of them, and they're going to amaze people.
Well, in fact, I'm going to have to cut in right there because we have 2 minutes left before we have to say our bye-byes. But, John, there's just something about, I just still can't believe, a pilotless fighter. I mean, you know, the fighter pilot, when you Tom Cruise, what, you know, the Top Gun.
And that will probably be the last role of significance that drones and UAVs take over. Right now, DARPA is getting ready to run a program where they're going to go ahead and take an A-10 and convert it to a UAV to discuss and demonstrate danger close, automated close air support. Give it 10 years, you're going to see fighters being flown in air-to-air against other drones.
Well, you want to say goodbye, Dwight?
Goodbye, Dwight.
We got to
goodbye, Dwight.
Now. Okay, thank you. And Dwight, stay on for just a second. We still have a minute to go. Thank you, John.
Thank you, John. And Chuck, thank you.
I guess we're getting an echo here.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me on.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Time goes by fast, doesn't it?
It sure does.
I was very impressed with the folks that you have on, and I'm looking forward to future programs of At Ease. Maybe you could get some kind of a sergeant to be your, what would we say, some kind of a hello. Well, with the last 30 seconds, Dwight, there we go. You going to hit that, Nina? Yeah, she's got the theme coming up under. And folks, next week, we'll be Dale will be coming back, and I believe we're going to do a rerun. Isn't that right, Nina? Yeah, she's shaking her head. So this is Bob Gould, that's right, the old Bob, 101st Airborne, saying once again to all the listeners at Veterans Radio, you are dismissed.
All views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily of Veterans Radio or the station. Veterans Radio is a production of Veterans Radio, LLC.